The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Are, so to speak, the lenses through which we can view reality, and based on those lenses determine the way our world looks to us and what kind of encounter we have with Hashem, with God. So each and every one of these attributes, according to mystical teachings, Kabbalah and the Torah, each one is a particular window through which the ineffable, infinite can be, so to speak, encountered. The first, the lower level over here, these three and four, Malchus kingdom is the receptacle for it all. But these three are really seeing God as manifest as the power underlying nature, the source and the power of nature. Now, to be very clear, I'm not saying that God is nature. Judaism is not saying God is nature. But that through nature, certain, let's put it, light of God is manifest. So the light of God that is manifest through nature is viewed through these attributes. So it's seeing the powers of nature and the inherent divinity within the powers of nature. The next three are really the moral powers. Seeing Hashem, God, as the source and the underlying power behind and within and beyond ethics, kindness, justice, truth. Now as we explore the latter part of this, we are now looking to see who is the source and the essential power behind, within, beyond the intellectual powers. Where does thought come from? Where does intelligence come from? Where does intuition come from? Where does logic come from? Where does will come from? And that's what we're exploring today. Okay, that's what we're exploring today. So, to start actually from the top, going down. Keter is seeing the will in the universe. There is will in the universe. And will is a very difficult thing to conceptualize because it's not a thing. And it can't be conceptualized, yet we all experience will. Will is very mystical. Nobody knows where will comes from. No scientist has ever, and probably will never, be able to isolate, formulate, analyze what is will and where does it come from. We are bombarded with will. Nobody knows how I'm able to lift my hand. I just want to, and I simultaneously do it. Nobody can explain how I'm able to move my finger. I just want to. Nobody can explain the will. The will. Where does will come from? Will is bombarding us all the time. For me to stand there, I have to have will. For me to speak, I have to have will. For me to want to go to sleep, I have to have will. Everything needs will. Without will, that's it. The game is over. Will is really life force. If a person loses their will to live, they die. If a person were to absolutely, completely lose their will to live, they will die. And sometimes, God forbid, diseases are a function of a real lack of will to live. Right? Now, of course, you have to be very careful that if a person is sick, you don't right away judge them and say, oh, they must have a lack of will to live. You know, I think you have to be very careful in the application of this towards individuals. But it's important to understand, will is mysterious. And yet, it's coming down all the time. Right? That I will is not my choice. What I will is my choice. But I didn't choose to will. Did you follow that? It wasn't my choice to will, and it's not my choice not to will. Will is life. Nobody asked me if I wanted to be alive. Before I was born, nobody said, you want to be born. Right? But will, although it's coming down without my will, I have a choice what I want to do with will. But is will my own will? Do you follow this? So it's like, imagine yourself as a pipe. And water is flowing into you. Now you as a pipe can turn to this direction or that direction. But you can't not determine whether the water is flowing into you. So too, will is flowing into us all the time. Which way we channel it, into what activities we invest it, that's our choice. But we have no choice regarding choice. Right? We have no choice about choice. We just have choice. We're compelled. We have choice. Now, what choice do we make? And then it's important to realize that not making a choice is a choice also, of course. So we really have no choice to make choice. And so we have to make a choice. Did you figure that one out? Okay. The name that is associated with this attribute, when I begin to look at the world with the glasses of Keter, and I begin to be very sensitive to will. You know, I never really thought about will. But now I look around and see everything has willpower. Everything is filled with willpower. You know? Like, what is the ever-ready battery that's pushing ants? And when you see the termination of an ant with a crumb on his back, which apparently is like 5 or 10 times his own weight. I think they can take something like that. Any ant professionals here? And when you see an ant going up a wall, and he's got this huge crumb, and you see that determination, you say, what is that? This little scrawny little creature, what is this driving force? What is this driving force? Where does it come from? Is it his own? Am I the source of will? I'm not the source of will. I didn't discover will. I didn't create will. Right? It's just coming in. So who is the source of will? Remember, this gets back to the whole question. You know, if a person wants to believe in the Big Bang, that's very nice. But the Big Bang doesn't address where does will come from. You know? I'd be happy with the Big Bang if it was trying to describe maybe a physical reality. But what is will? How did will evolve? When you really start to understand the power of will, the mystery of will, the energy of will. And so, Keter is connected to will, and it's connected to the name Ekyeh. Ekyeh. The name Ekyeh, I say Ekyeh because I don't want to really pronounce the name, but we see this name in the story where Moses has been called upon to go to Egypt and bring the Jewish people out of Egypt, right? And there's a very interesting dialogue recorded in the Torah whereby Moses addresses God and says, well, you know, who are you? If they ask me, who is this God that's sending you, what should I say? And so God says, I am that I am. Have you ever heard that? Besides from Popeye the Sailor Man. Right? Because that's what Popeye used to say. That's the first time I heard it. I am that I am. All that I am, I'm a Popeye the Sailor Man. But that's, I don't know where he got that from. But that's, God forbid, not what this is about. I am that I am. And therefore you shall say to the Jewish people, I am sent you. What kind of name is that? I am. This is one of the names of God. The great I am. The great I am. Now this is very interesting. You see, Keter is also connected to
let's call it super conscience.
I am conscious. Consciousness. Awareness. I'm not talking yet about intelligence or rationality or just simple awareness. The ability to say, I am. Right? You know. You are aware. Okay? It's beautiful to watch a baby as the baby grows. You just see awareness. Right? As he goes and plays with this little ball with a little bell inside of it. And he can play with it for hours. And he's in awe and wonder of the same toy. I mean, this morning, I put my baby on the floor. And I put these three toys on the floor. And I looked, I said, I would go nuts. I mean, these are the same toys he plays with every single day. And when I put that ball down, which he has seen for months, he looks at it like, oh, a new toy. And for him, it's always new. That just that simple awareness. Before he's formulated, before he's defined, before he is labeled. There's just that simple awareness. Where does awareness come from? Who created awareness? What's the source of awareness? Am I the source of awareness? Did awareness start with me? Did consciousness start with me? And God forbid, but when I die, will consciousness end with me? Maybe my consciousness, right? But can I really say it's my consciousness? Do I own it? Am I the master of it? Did I create it? Did I earn it? And so, I am that I am. This is who the Jewish people believe in. The great I am that I am. The source, the independent source of everything. And some people call that God. Well, if you don't like that name, quite frankly, as you've noticed, that's not one of the names of God in Judaism. G-O-D is not found in the Bible. Maybe in a translation in English, but that's a translation. In the original Bible, G-O-D is no such thing. There are all these different names which give us an experiential encounter with the ultimate reality. And one quality, so to speak, or the ultimate quality of this ultimate reality that I feel in encountering and I'm in relationship with of somehow, or seems to be addressing me or whatever, is who is the great I am that I am? You see, I cannot say I am that I am, because I am that I am not. Right? I am that I am not. Because I cannot say I am what is mine. Because nothing is mine. Let me read to you a passage from Heschel which just expresses it so brilliantly. I am endowed with a will, but the will is not mine. I am endowed with freedom, but it is a freedom imposed on the will. Life is something that visits my body, a transcendent loan. I have neither initiated it, nor conceived its worth and meaning. I didn't conceive the meaning of life. I'm not the founder of the meaning of life. Who gave life meaning? And yet life, we sense intuitively in a very deep way that life is meaningful and significant. But where do we get that? And when we feel it's not, and we get really depressed about that, that itself is an affirmation that I believe it is. Because if it wasn't, why wouldn't we get upset about it? And so I have this intuitive sense that life must be meaningful. And when I start to think and I conclude, well, it's not, that really upsets me deeply, because that goes against my very grain, my inner knowledge that, but it must be. It's gotta be. I know it is, but yet I don't seem to see it, but I know it inside. Well, who determined that? And so, life is something that visits my body, a transcendent loan. I have neither initiated nor conceived its worth and meaning. The essence of what I am is not mine. It's not my life. That's the greatest mistake people make. They think it's my life. You're the founder of life. You created life. You've determined life. No, it's really not my life. It's a transcendental loan. It's on loan. Everything I own, I essentially owe. Because it's really not mine. It's on loan. So therefore, the essence of what I am is not mine. I am what is not mine. Therefore, I am that I am not. Only the divine can say, I am that I am. Right? Because I am the source. But I cannot say that. I am not the source of love. I am a channel for love in the world, I hope. I try. I am not the source of wisdom, but I try to be a channel of wisdom into the world. I am not the source of will, but I am a channel that channels will into the world. And then for my essence, life, love, intelligence, none of that's mine. I don't own it. I can't really control it. I can't create it. I can only share it. I can only channel it. And therefore, when a person looks at the world through the looking glass of Keter, what they all of a sudden see is will. And they all of a sudden see the I am that I am peering through it all by seeing that everything is I am what I'm not. I become very sensitive to looking at the world to realize that everything I see can only say I am what I'm not. Because what I am isn't mine. I don't own it. I'm not the source of it. I'm not the beginning of it. And I'm not the end of it. And that's an incredible experience. Remember I mentioned to you, if you wear glasses or contact lens as well, you go into an optometrist and then you come out after you just got a new prescription, you look and all of a sudden you see things you never saw before. Right? New prescription. Well, when you wear the glasses of Keter, all of a sudden you start to become very sensitive to will. All of a sudden you become very sensitive to that which is not mine. And that's a very high level. It gives people tremendous amount of peace. On one level, it's important to know when the world is falling apart, well, one thing's important to remember, it's not your world, right? You're there to help. You can play a role. You can be an important channel. But it's not my world. You know, I've met people who have this messianic complex. Going to save the Jewish people. They're not my people. I mean, they're my people in terms of we're one people together. But I didn't create history. I'm not the source of history. I can participate and I will try and participate. But I have to know where I am so I don't get confused. It can help me in so many ways. You know, so much pain happens when I begin to take control and begin to think that I own my life. And then I'm not able to let go when I should be letting go. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm just going to be irresponsible. It's not my life. It doesn't matter. No. It's not my life. It's on loan. And I have a responsibility towards it. It's been entrusted to me. Life is a trust fund. But it's not mine. And what happens is, God forbid, when a person falls to the misunderstanding that it is my life, then what's going to happen in their life, according to Judaism, is something that's going to force them to realize it's not my life. This is what's going to happen. It's not my life. When a person is so sure that they're in control of everything, as if they're the source of everything, then just the way things are going to work, because that's the way God planned it, is that an event of some sort is going to happen, which is only trying to help me put these glasses on so I can see. So I can be in touch with reality and I can be happy. And I can be alive. And I can be open to even receive more life. Rather than being so controlled that I just get so rigid and so overbearing that I can't kind of let go a little bit. So when a person looks at the world through the lenses of Ratzon, through the lenses of Keter, crown, becoming very sensitive to ultimate will, super consciousness, realizing that my consciousness is only a drop in the ocean of consciousness, But I'm not the ocean, right? When I realize that, it puts me in a completely different state of being in life and attitude. Yeah?
If we're all from one source, then what's the purpose of an individual?
Right. You've taken off the glasses of Netzach and Hod. Because Netzach and Hod sees the troops, the great array, the cast of the drama. In a play, every single individual in the play is manifesting a very important message of the one author who wrote the script completely. Each and every character in the play, in a certain way, is playing out something about the author himself.
But we form ourselves. I mean, from birth, we're one person, but as life goes on, we take on different characteristics that come from within us.
Yeah, I know, but who wrote the script and put those characteristics in you? And who designed the script and who designed the scene that you ended up with this kind of parent or that kind of brother or that kind of financial situation or that kind of wealth situation or that kind of difficult situation? In other words, yes, we have free choice, but on the other hand, there still is the director who is carefully directing us. Remember, we talked about Netzach and Hod as almost experiencing God as a grand chess player, right? Who knows exactly how to put the move down in order to carefully guide you to choose the move He wants you to choose. You chose that move. You made that choice. You chose that move. But nonetheless, you chose that move, and yet it still fits into the Grandmaster's plan. That's a long discussion, and that was really belongs into Netzach and Hod. So forgive me if I just don't want to get into that now. But right now, I want to continue to understand this very important point. That the self did not originate with itself. And when a person becomes sensitive to self, who is the self? The self is the most unknowable. You would think the self is the most knowable. I'm myself. If I don't know myself, how can I know anything? Well, the truth is that the self is the most elusive, most difficult. Why is the self so difficult? Because the self is the one who's doing the seeing. Can the eyes see themselves? No, they're the ones that are doing the seeing. Can the ears hear themselves? No, they're the ones that are doing the hearing, right? Can the teeth eat themselves? No, they're the ones that are doing the eating. Can the nose smell itself? No, it's the one that's doing the smelling. So the self, right? The self is the most unknowable because it's the one doing all the knowing. The real inner self, the true self. Now, it's important to now understand. So when people say, well, why can't I see God? Well, often people think the reason why they can't see God is because God is so far. And God is like in heaven, up there. Right? And perhaps someday when scientific technology has evolved, maybe someday we can create some kind of spaceship, cosmoship, that will take me to the edge of the cosmos. And there, when we finally get to the edge, we will see two eyes peering at us. Welcome, I am God. It'll never happen. God is not waiting at the edge of space. You see, the reason why we cannot see God is because, not that God is too far from us, but because God is too close to us. Because God is closer than our own eyeballs. As it says in the Gemara Brachot, in the Talmud Brachot, just as the soul sees and yet is unseen, so too God. The soul is the one doing the seeing, and therefore it cannot be seen. Sight cannot be described by what it sees, right? Hearing cannot be described by sounds. It's the one hearing sounds, but it itself cannot be described by sounds. And so too, the attribute of keter is associated with nothing. Ein, nothing. What is nothing? Why is it that when a person looks at this lens, they encounter reality as nothing? Because there is no word that I can find that can describe reality. So it's essentially as if it's nothing. But it's not nothing as the opposite of something. It's actually a very lofty nothing, meaning that this reality is so great, so beyond, and the source of all knowledge, and the source of all consciousness, and the source of all will, and the source of all words, and the source of all thoughts, that the source of all thoughts and words cannot be described by thoughts and words. Because it's the source of thoughts and words. Just as seeing cannot be described by sight. Just as hearing cannot be described by sounds. The only way you could know hearing is when you experience participating in the process of hearing. Right? And you'll never be able to describe it. No one will be able to describe the sensation of hearing. But you know I'm hearing. No one will be able to describe the sensation of seeing. But you know you're seeing. Because there is no concept and there is no word that can describe it. Because it's the one doing all the describing. So too, at this point, with this encounter with reality, and I'm asked to think of God, I should draw a blank. A total blank. Because I realize that there's absolutely no word, no concept, no image to capture the source of all consciousness. If I'm asked to think of God, I try to experience the source of my consciousness. The source of will. I try to experience participation in awareness. Knowing that I'm not the source of it, I'm only participating. I try to experience participation in will. Knowing that I'm not the source of it. It didn't start with me, it's not going to end with me. But participation. It's very important. There are certain things that you can only know through participation. Nobody will be able to describe it to you. But you can know, and you yourself will never be able to describe it, but the way you know is through participation. Getting involved. Participation. When I'm involved in the process of making a choice, and I begin to experience the wonder and the power in will, and I realize I'm not the source of this. It didn't start with me. It's not going to end with me. I'm just participating in this reality of will. That's an amazing experience. That's an amazing experience. And therefore, all the other lenses is kind of looking at the world, seeing God through nature, seeing the divine expressed in morality. But now we're seeing the divine expressed in seeing, in the very experience of seeing itself, the very experience of thinking itself. The very experience of awareness itself. And so, this brings us to the next lens going down. What is wisdom and what is understanding? And they are connected to each other in that way. Wisdom is innovative, unpredicted. It's an innovative, unpredicted force of intuition. Flashes. Can you remember the time you had a flash besides a Kodak flash, right? But the time you had a flash, something hit you. Can you remember when you're walking in the shopping mall and you get this flash of insight. And you weren't working on this. You weren't even, as far as you know, even thinking about this. But all of a sudden something hits you, and you go, and I'm not talking about memory. Like often I get this flash, like, oh, I better call so-and-so. I wasn't even thinking of calling. It was just all of a sudden I'm just kind of told, remember to call so-and-so. That's an experience itself. But that's not even what we're talking about. We're talking about a creative, spontaneous, intuitive, lightning bolt. The light flashes and you get this idea. And that's the way it's described, is getting an idea. Right? Or you conceive an idea. What does conceive mean? Who impregnated you? Right? To conceive an idea. Why is it called to conceive? Right? Where does this come from? Am I the source of it? Remember, I was at someone's home, and for the first course, they had this food I'd never seen before. And I said, what is this? I've never seen this before. I said, sweetbreads. This is really interesting. But what is it? I've never tasted it. And I said, well, it's really brain. Brain? I'm eating brain? I mean, it was bad enough to be eating tongue. Did you ever get tongue, you know? As a kid, they used to give us tongue. I didn't know what it was until I went. One day saw it in the window. You'd see this big cow's tongue go, man, I don't want to eat that again. So I'd never eaten sweet bread. You know, it didn't look like bread. And to find its brain. And when you boil it down to that, and you look at it at your plate, do you really think that's where your will's coming from? Do you really think that's where your thoughts are coming from? Do you really think, you know, that if we were to open the head of Einstein, that all that brilliance was in his sweetbread? No way. I just doesn't strike me right. Where is it? I saw an incredible film. It was a documentary. And this guy was basically doing what they call a mind experiment. In other words, not doing really an experiment, but like in our minds, imagining an experiment. So basically, this documentary starts off with, in the middle of the room is this glass case. Inside this glass case is a brain. And little water is shooting at it to keep it, you know, from drying out. Kind of looks like that thing when you go to a snack bar and you ask for some juice and it's got this little thing, you know. So well, you don't know what this is. You think, oh, maybe the guy's going to have a glass of soda or something. And the guy's walking around this little aquarium with something inside which you quite don't see yet that has water, you know, being sprayed at it, right? And the guy's walking around and he starts to talk and he says, this is my brain, right? I have removed my brain so we can get a chance to look at it, right? And all of a sudden you say, wait a second. And you realize that he's looking at it and he's describing it, but he's outside of it. It's very, very effective to start to get in touch with, do you really think you're in here? Is the self inside this sweet bread? Where does the self come from? How did the self evolve? How did the self evolve? Especially when you think of the power of self. Where does self, consciousness, and these flashes of brilliance, ingenuity. Every time I get on a plane, just as I'm about to get on, I just start to laugh. I just look at this huge, I don't know how many tons this thing weighs, and I say, this is going to get off the ground? No way. And I just spontaneously laugh. Just like a child who laughs at something that they've really never seen before. They just kind of laugh from the surprise of it. I just start to laugh every time I'm about to get on this plane.
Of course, there's no laughing matter because they then tell you to put on your seatbelts and they tell you what might happen, God forbid, it, whatever.
So I stop laughing at that point. But if you look at the world, and you look at the world through the eyes of Keter and Chachma and Bina, you'd start to laugh hysterically. Because you're in shock. How could this be? The human ingenuity,
did it crank out from this blob of flesh that's inside my skull? Am I really willing to buy into that? I once asked this fellow, I was talking to him about soul. Talking about soul. He said, I don't believe in soul. I don't believe in spirituality. None of that stuff. It's all a bunch of garbage. So I said to him, I said, but, you know, well, how would you describe your relationship with your wife? I mean, what are the dynamics between you and your wife? Is that a spiritual encounter? He said, no, it's just neural impulses. I said, have you ever shared that with your wife? You know, could you imagine a nice romantic evening? He says, sweetheart, your neural impulses just turn my neural on. But okay, if you're willing to think that you are the subtotal of neural impulses, well then, once again, that's okay. You have the choice to do that. That will be the nature of your relationships. That will be the world you will live in. You will world and live in a world which is populated by beings that are programmed with all kinds of neural impulses. That's the world I want to see. That's the world I'm going to see. That's the world I live in. But when I look at the world through the glasses of Keter Chachman Bina, when I look at the world through the glasses, I begin to become very aware and sensitive to will and consciousness. I become very well aware, and all of a sudden I start to become very aware of brilliance, ingenuity, that stroke of genius, that flash of incredible creativity. And I begin to say, who is the master of all this? Am I the source of all this? Or should I humbly be thankful that I was a receptacle, I was a channel for it into the world? These are experiences that very often musicians, composers get. They don't have a sense that they're doing it. They get a sense that it's being done through them. It's an experience of a painter who paints a picture but has a difficulty in signing his name. How can I sign this? Can I say this is mine? Have you ever written a poem just spontaneously, it just hit you and you just felt moved? Which itself is an interesting word. I was moved. Spirit moved me, whatever. And you write something and your hand just moves, and it's not as if you have a chance to think or formulate your thoughts. They're just pouring out of you. And then you look at it and you just say, that's mine. My poem. My song. And the other night I was in the cab and they were doing a whole hour on Bob Dylan. You know? And I was thinking, you know, some really beautiful stuff. Does he think, me? My song? I did it? Well, in an interview with Bob Dylan that I heard a long time ago, he said something to the effect of, well, Bob, how do you write songs? He said, I just put my pen on the page and I just know it's going to be all right. Now go to school and learn how to do that. That flash, that spontaneous, unpredicted, you're hoping it's going to happen. Sometimes you sit down, you know it's going to be all right, but it doesn't come out. This is not, I don't, it's not happening. I mean, it's not, how do you, what is it that's happening? Who's the it that's happening? I mean, it's very easy in English to say, it's raining. Who's raining? Right? In English, we have to find some kind of noun, you know, subject. It's raining. Who's raining? Right? It's happening. Well, who's the it? Who's the it? And so, Chachma is that innovative blast, flash, brilliance, ingenuity, spark of genius. Boom. But that's not enough. Because then it has to be processed. It has to be processed. It has to be articulated, formulated, structured. Have you ever had an experience where you know the answer, but you don't know what it is? Have you ever been in class and the teacher says, you know, throws out a question, and you go, oh, and you put your hand up immediately, and you say, yes, and you go, And you look, you feel really dumb. You feel totally dumb because why did I put my hand up? Yes, you have the answer. Yeah, I have the answer. Go ahead. What do you mean? Because when your hand went up, that was chachma. You had that flash, you had that seed, but you didn't take time yet to really pull it out, draw out the details, formulate it in words, get it conceptualized. So you need a little more time. So you put your hand down and say, excuse me, give me a second, right? And then at that point, the teacher turns to somebody else, and then you put your hand up again, but it's too late, and you're so angry, because now you really have it. What do you mean? I've had this experience. I remember when I was at yeshiva, and we were studying over a piece of Gemara, Talmud. And we're working on a very difficult piece, and you're kind of cracking open what's the problem, what's going on, there's a difficulty, and And I remember numerous times where my chavruta, my learning partner, and I would be staring at the page, and exactly, with perfect synchronicity, we both go, I got it. You got it? I got it. You first. No, you first. It happened. It was like, you feel like this thing came down. We were both in the same place. If the water falls down on your head and you're both standing next to each other, you're both going to get wet. It's at the same moment. We looked at each other and we went, got it. You go ahead. No, you go ahead. Well, I don't. I mean, one second. And then we put our heads down again. We said, okay, now I got it. Now what was that second, now I got it? Didn't you get it the first time? The first time is the experience of wisdom. You know, maybe it's a whiz, right? It's pshew, got it. But it hasn't evolved. That's bina. Really understanding it. Pulling it apart, giving it structure, and really filling it in. Really filling it in. But all this are the faculties of mind. Where does mind come from? Who is the source of mind? And can I really say that it's my mind? Yes, it's been entrusted to me. And yes, I will do whatever I can with it. But to think it's mine is a big mistake. The way the Torah sees it. And so let's go over the whole map right now, see what we have learned, see if through it we can heighten our sensitivities to life. Maybe we can start, so to speak, to smell the flowers again. I remember one day I was walking with my son and we were kind of smelling flowers. It was really sweet. And then my son went over to a bush, put his nose into the bush and went, ah. So I looked at my son, I said, it's a bush. So I went up to him, I said, what are you doing? He doesn't know, you see, I've been pre-programmed, flowers, you smell flowers, right? He doesn't know that. So he goes over to a bush, and he goes, ah, and I'm looking and going, wait a second. And then I go over to this bush and go, and I realize, hey, it also has a fragrance. And he introduced me to a sensation that I never even knew existed. And that really what Torah is offering us is the possibility to see colors that we never even knew were there. To start tasting, taste, never even knew it was there. The other day I went into a juice bar and I hear somebody say, wow, this papaya stuff's great. I never tasted papaya juice. I don't even know what it tastes like, you know? And there it is, right? And I say to the guy, and I'm struggling here, should I just go ahead with the carrot juice? So I said, you know what? Put half a papaya in it. The guy put half a papaya in it. I drank it. It was Gan Eden. It was the Garden of Eden. I never tasted anything like this. Never tasted anything like that, and I might never have if I just would never accept that there might be other tastes out there. So the Talmud said that we will be held accountable for all the fruits in this world we didn't taste. Unbelievable. There are great Hasidic Rebbes who made it,
part of their business, so to speak, to taste all the fruits, and got exotic fruits from all over the world, to taste that spark of godliness that's being manifest through this fruit. Because every taste in this world is only going to help us taste the next world. Taste the next world. And so, if we don't open ourselves up to new tastes, new sensations, that, wow, there's a whole life I could be missing right there. There's a Hasidic story about a fellow who was a horse driver, right? His whole life was his horse. He loved his horse. And he was committed to his horse. And he fed his horse. He took care of his horse. And then, one day, his horse died. He was very sad about that. Very sad about it. Right? And he was a good man. And when he died, he was taken to the Garden of Eden. And when he got to the Garden of Eden, he wasn't happy. Because none of this was familiar to him. None of this was what his life was filled with. So therefore God had compassion on him and sent him to a world where he could continue to ride a horse. It's a Hasidic story. Not that I'm saying it's a true story. The point is that when I get to the Garden of Eden, if I don't have a sense of what these sensations are, then they won't be sensations. I won't be open to it. I won't have the built-in lenses to see any of this. So what Torah claims it's offering us is to taste God in our lives all the time. And that's considered to be an ecstatic, pleasurable experience. Now some people say, gee, I don't want to taste God, because they have a very unfortunate, crystallized misconception of God. And the first misconception is that they've got a conception at all. That's the first thing a person's got to start dealing with. But each one of these attributes is a lens which lets me see a new color, a new sensation of sight and sound and taste and feel and life. And it's been very difficult, because maybe some of these sensations we've really never had, not even sure they exist. So Malchus is that vessel. First of all, it's opening vessel. To be an open vessel to receive what's there. And to realize that to receive what's there, I've got to be part of a community. Because I am not an independent, isolated individual, but I'm part of a community. And as a member of a community, I can receive what's there. When I put on the glasses of Yesod, I look and I see life. And I become aware of life. And I know I can't put life under a microscope. I can't formulate it in mathematical terms. But one knows that sensation of life. When a person feels alive, when a person feels dead, that's a sensation we know, and it's very real. And that life, that aliveness, is actually the entire synergy of all these flavors. It's the dish. Aliveness is when I taste Netzach, Hod, Tiferet, Gevura, Chesed, Keter, when I taste all that together, then I have embodied aliveness. And such people are full of aliveness. And then we wanted to try and break down, if it's possible, to break down this delicious dish called life and aliveness, that spirit, into the various ingredients, that it is surely a whole greater than the sum of the parts. And so we began to become very sensitive to Netzach and Hod, the choreography of life. That life is a choreography. It's not a static community. But this community is a drama. And we're really part of a cast of hosts. We're part of a troupe. And we realize that sometimes you're out of line, And it's not a good feeling to be out of line. Because I want to be in line. And I want to be part of that. Because it's animated. We looked at Tiferet, which is the beauty and the realness. And when a person doesn't feel realness, and they're still somewhat living in their concepts only, living in their memories only, and don't taste the realness, then they're missing the essence of life. Realness. We then explored kindness and appreciation of looking at the world and realizing that nothing has to be. Nothing at all has to be. Wow, it is. Don't take it for granted. Share it with others. Do things that you don't have to do. I don't owe you to be nice. I want to be nice. And it's an amazing thing in the hotel world, I was told, people are so nice in hotels. How are you today, sir? How was your room today, sir? Can I get you a taxi today, sir? Have a nice day, sir. It's unbelievable. I remember when I was at the King David Hotel with Kirk Douglas, and we walked into the lobby, and everybody, how are you, Mr. Douglas? How's things going, Mr. Douglas? Is everything okay, Mr. Douglas? How's your room, Mr. Douglas? Oh, you look terrific today, Mr. Douglas. He's going, thanks, thanks. We walk into the elevator, he turns to me, says, they kill you with their kindness. You know, it's like, do you really think they're being kind? Kindness is doing what you don't have to do. These people have to do it. It's their job to do that. They're being paid to do that. But you know, a friend of mine told me that a lot of people go to hotels intentionally to feel people being nice to them. Of course, it's somewhat an illusion because you know that they're being paid to be nice. That's their job. They are professional nice. But what a terrific experience when a person is nice and you know they don't have to be nice to you. That's amazing. I don't have to be nice to you, and I am. Because this world didn't have to be, and you and I don't have to be, and therefore the world is an expression of kindness. And to be in sync with that, I want to do things that I don't have to do. But also when I look at the world, a world that doesn't have to be, there are rules, there are regulations, there are violations. There's not only doing what I don't have to do, but there are things that I do have to do. Because if I don't do it, I violate borders. I get out of line. I damage the interdependence of us all. And so I saw Gvura. And then today we began to not only be sensitive to the natural powers within, beyond, and become sensitive to what is the source of all these natural powers? Who is the source? Mi bara elu. Who created all this? Who is the source of all this? Who is the energy of all this? And then we became sensitive to the ethical, moral powers. Who is the source of love? Who is the source of justice? Who is the source of kindness? And then we became sensitive to the intellectual powers. Who is the source of wisdom? Who is the source of consciousness? Who is the source of will? I don't believe in God. I believe in the great who. And that's not Peter Townsend, although I have great respect for him. The who. I believe in the who. And when I walk into my children's bedroom and I pick up my son and I look at his little eyes and his little nose and his hands and I'm holding that baby, at that moment, it's absolutely clear. What an incredibly evolved monkey. See, that's just not the words. When I'm holding my baby, I just spontaneously say, thank God. And then I say, who? Who? I don't know who. But whoever you are, thank you. Thank you.
You talk about messages and you get messages. Is that intuition?
You know, messages.
Explain intuition versus, like, you know.
Look, messages is a very dangerous area, you know, because you think you got this message. I could interpret it completely different. So you got to be very, very careful before you start saying, I'm getting messages. Right? You get a flash, and you might not know how to interpret it. But it's hard to say, I'm getting messages.
Is that separate? That's something good.
Look, a person has an intuition. You have intuition. I have intuition. Things strike me. I can't explain it. But I say, this is, you know. Yes, and some people are very intuitive, and some people think they're intuitive. I don't know, you know, but I can't describe it. But sometimes you just are very intuitive that this is the right thing. Now, you have to understand that if you're very intuitive that this is the right thing, but logically it's the wrong thing, then you don't go ahead with your intuition. Right? If you're very intuitive that this is the right thing, but logically it could go either way, you can go with your intuition. But if logically something's saying no, don't go on. Because, you know, Bina is logic. Chachma is intuition. They got to work together, right? There's got to be some kind of harmony between them. So now if you're dating a guy and your heart says yes, but your mind says no, don't do it. Forget it. If you're dating a guy and your head says yes, but your heart says no, don't do it. But if you're dating a guy and your head says yes, and your heart says yes, well, that's easy. That's a bingo, right? But it doesn't happen that easy most of the time, unfortunately. But if you're dating a guy and your head says yes, and your heart just simply has no opinion, keep going. Or if your heart says yes, but your head simply has no opinion, it could go either way, keep going, right? And that's the relationship between, you know. And then you pray. You know, when I was engaged to my wife, I prayed to Hashem every day that I have the guidance and the wisdom and the insight whether I'm making the right choice. I was already engaged. I prayed every single day. And I remember 2 hours before my wedding. You know, you have these two guardians that are supposed to, you know, protect you. The truth is they're supposed to make sure you don't run away. But anyways, they tell you it's to protect you of any problems that might occur. But anyways, but as you're walking down the aisle and they're holding you. But anyway, so I remember my two shomrim, my two guardians are watching me, and I went to the kotel, and it was just before I'm going to get in the cab. I'm going to go and get married and change my life completely. And I prayed to God and I cried to God. I said, if I'm making a mistake, let me know. I don't think I'm making a mistake. I feel good with this. But don't save me the embarrassment. It's okay. If it means my parents will never speak to me again, it's okay. If it means I'll be in debt for all the flowers and everyone's just going to eat the food and I won't show up, it's okay. But I am an open vessel. But I think this is the right choice. And unless something goes right into me, right? And I'm not talking about a black cat walks in front of me. That must have meant that I shouldn't marry a girl who likes black cats. Whatever. You got to be open. Got to be open. To be alive means to be open. And yet it also means to be in touch and to be careful and to be cautious. So we value that intuition, but it must be in concert with logic, and they're completely different. Neither one is expected to be the same. Right? Neither one is expected to be the same.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.